Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning local news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, with a record high single-day case count on Thursday, Utah's coronavirus spike continues. Senator Mitt Romney says he supports allowing a vote on a nominee to replace late Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Body camera footage in the police shooting of an autistic boy in Salt Lake City gets released. And officials in Grand County object to a proposed highway spanning Utah's remote Book Cliffs. Joining me on the show today, we have Salt Lake Tribune reporter Lee Davidson. Thanks for being here, Lee. Good morning.
Good morning, Roger.
And we've also got reporter Jessica Miller. And Jessica, good morning to you. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
And shortly, hopefully, we'll also have Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke. We will see about that. And later in the show, we'll hear from Tribune public lands reporter Brian Maffley. But for now, I will mention to listeners that if you'd like to submit your questions and comments about the stories we are covering today, you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. You can also call 801-355-8255 to be a part of this discussion. I'm going to skip for now the spike in cases in coronavirus and jump instead to a conversation about some news that dominated the news cycle this week. And Lee Davidson, that was the death of the of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the role that she played on the Supreme Court, and of course her pretty remarkable biography. We will be tackling some of the process that her death set in place and the questions that emerged about nominating a replacement after her passing. There's a lot of background to cover there, Lee, but there was, in the hours just after Justice Ginsburg's death, a lot of attention being paid to Senator Mitt Romney. Why was that the case, Lee?
Well, many supporters of Ruth Bader Ginsburg hoped that the Senate would not take a quick vote to replace her on a new nominee. And to prevent that, there needed to be at least four Republicans who would break ranks with their party. Two senators did that immediately, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Sue Collins of Maine. And so everyone's eyes shifted quickly to Mitt Romney, thinking he might join them, and maybe a fourth person that could stop this quick move to confirm a new nominee. Romney was silent for a while, but then he came out with a statement saying, no, this time I'm going to stick with my party. And then he listed his reasons. Bear in mind that 4 years ago, Republicans did refuse to have a confirmation hearing for Merrick Garland, a Democrat nominated by Barack Obama. Many of their leaders at the time argued that that's too close to the election. Need to wait for the election to be over so that the new president can put forward his or her nominee.
Right.
However, this time the argument was now, you know, historical precedent is that when a president's party is in power in the Senate, they go ahead and confirm that nominee. Anyway, Romney put out an explanation saying he agrees with that argument, that it's the responsibility of a president to nominate someone, the responsibility of the Senate to consider them and have a vote. He said it's not a matter of fairness, which in his words is in the eye of the beholder. He said he thinks he's following the Constitution and historical precedent.
That's the background. And as you said, he's given his justification for why he won't break with his party. And of course, part of the context there is that he did break with his party in a vote on impeachment in the Senate, being the only Republican senator to vote for the impeachment of the president on one count. Yeah,
been a pretty constant critic of the president on such things as foreign policy and his inflammatory tweets. And Trump has criticized him right back earlier this month, calling him our worst senator. Earlier this year, he said he doesn't want the advice of Senator Romney. And ironically, because of Romney, he now will be able to get the advice and consent of the Senate on his nominee. And Trump has said that he will nominate a woman and that he'll do it tomorrow on Saturday at 5 p.m. Eastern.
Wow. And we have some suspicions about who that will be. I want to, just on the on what Romney said about what happened in 2016, Lee, both you and I were on a press call with Senator Romney earlier this week, and I tried to ask him about the charges of hypocrisy from Democrats, and I guess I'll play that clip. I asked Senator Romney to address the idea that it was, you know, hypocritical for Republicans to fill this seat, which is what many Democrats are charging, having to do with that, you know, withholding hearings for Senator Merrick Garland. You'll hear the tail end of my question, which kind of makes me cringe a little bit, but the way I ask it here, take a listen, Lee and everybody
else. Your questions always sound a lot better than mine.
Disagree, but yeah. Here we go. You know, specifically people like Senator Lindsey Graham saying, mark my words, you know, if this happens, if this situation comes up, I'm not going to vote that way. And I, you know, you're not Senator Graham, I guess, but can you address those charges at all? Maybe it's not for you to address.
Well, I think you're right, which is that there are individuals who will need to explain their point of view, but I can't speak for them. I wouldn't presume to speak for other senators. So I can tell you in my own circumstances, I instead looked at the law and precedent, I do note that the majority leader, Senator McConnell, did explain at the time of his Garland decision that he was following precedent, which is that a Senate of one party has not always confirmed the nominee of the president of another party in an election year. And consistent with that precedent, he was following that course. Others said other things, which were not as clear as what he said, and you would have to address those concerns to them.
Okay, and again, yeah, right. Romney saying, look, I wasn't in the Senate at the time, and this is, you know, you got to ask Lindsey Graham about those charges of hypocrisy. And of course, Lindsey Graham did say, Lee, that he, you know, that in various occasions that, you know, you should hold him to it. And now he is siding with the president and he will consider the president's nominee. I did get a little hung up by something that Romney said, which was that he pointed to Mitch McConnell talking about what the Republican-controlled Senate did when it came to Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee, and we all know that they shut that nomination down. It was an election year, as you said, Lee, and that was many months earlier in an election year, by the way. But McConnell had said that there was a historical precedent for an opposition-controlled Senate not confirming a Supreme Court nominee in an election year, and maybe I'm really in the weeds on this, but not confirming is not the same as withholding confirmation hearings, which is what the Republicans did with Garland back in 2016. And that hadn't happened for a Supreme Court nominee, at least before Garland, though confirmation hearings are a 20th century contrivance and, you know, they're not required by the Constitution. I don't know. You know, Lee, we could talk the story to death, but we should probably turn to the story of Utah's other senator, and that's Senator Mike Lee and his position on the vacancy that was left behind by the death of Justice Ginsburg. Lee, of course, wasn't considered a potential defector from his party, but he has a preferred candidate for this job. Lee, who is that?
Well, that's Amy Comey Barrett, who most people see as the leading candidate. And Lee turned into kind of a cheerleader for her this week, saying he really likes her. He thinks she's in the mold of several recent conservative nominees and is pushing for her. He says he hopes she is the nominee and she would do a good job of interpreting the law instead of making the law, which is a big thing for him. Might also note that Senator Lee takes a little bit different tack than many Republicans who say it's too close to the election, don't proceed because of that. He's one who likes to point to some analysis done by the National Review, which is a conservative publication, that looked at how many nominees have occurred during an election year. there were 29 in history, and in all 29 cases, the president made a nomination. But when a different party controlled the Senate than the presidency, there were 10 cases, and 9 of those were rejected. And so he says, see, this is precedent, this is what we follow. And he says, frankly, the Senate's a political beast, and it's okay to wield our political power. We don't need to make excuses. You know, this is what we do. It's big league politics, and we flex our muscle.
And that's yet again a justification. The columnist Robert Gerke wrote about Lee's position, if I had him here, I'd ask him about that. But I guess we're expecting a nomination tomorrow. Lee, you said 5:00 Eastern. Do we think it's going to be Amy Comey Barrett? Can you tell us a little bit?
If you're betting money, okay, I would bet on her from what people are writing. But presidents tend to surprise you. He has a short list of 5 people, all women. And he's still interviewing some folks today. But he's apparently interviewed Barrett a couple of times this week. So, and also, he had been quoted 2 years ago when there was another opening saying that he wanted to save her for when Ruth Bader Ginsburg left. And that would be now.
That would be now. And, you know, just going back to Senator Romney, he talked about the court having been a somewhat liberal court before, and that basically it was time for a conservative court. Can you talk about how conservative the court will be, and then also what that might mean for future decisions before we head to a break?
I'm not a close court reporter, so I don't know how much I can tell you.
Sure.
But it's had a slim conservative margin that would become a bigger conservative margin. You know, there are some folks like the Chief Justice who kind of go back and forth depending on what the issue is. But this gives conservatives a much stronger, much clearer majority, which conservatives especially worry about in cases such as on abortion. And this is a huge deal for them.
Okay. Again, that is Salt Lake Tribune reporter Lee Davidson talking about the changes afoot and the nomination process for a new Supreme Court nominee. We are going to take a quick break in the show, and there is still more news ahead from this past week in Utah news, including the release of body camera footage and the police shooting of an autistic child in Salt Lake City. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
We're into this conversation now, and Jessica, you wrote about something that is a fairly regular part of your beat. This week you wrote about the release of body camera footage from a police shooting, and this was from a shooting that was not a regular police shooting. This involves a child, a 13-year-old boy, and if I'm not mistaken, before we jump into the story, according to a database of police shootings that the Tribune maintains, this is the youngest person on record to be shot by police in the state. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. We've been tracking police shootings all the way back to 2004, both fatal shootings and times when officers missed or just injured somebody, like what happened with this case with Lyndon Cameron. And he's by far the youngest person who's been shot by police since 2004.
Okay, and he's 13 years old. And we've actually described the basics of this particular incident on the show before, but that was prior to this footage being released. And so I will ask you, Jessica, to describe what this footage shows to begin with, and then we can get to some of the other details of this incident. But the footage, as is often the case, shows a pursuit and then a shooting. Tell us what it shows.
Yeah, so it shows, you know, kind of the beginning. So the police officers come to Lyndon's home, and they talk with his mother, and his mother says, you know, I need help. I'm trying to get him to a hospital. He was having, you know, sort of a breakdown and needed to get some care. And at some point, the officers decide to go into the home to get Lyndon, and he started running from the house into the backyard and jumped a fence and started running down the street. And the officers chased him. And at a certain point, he stopped running. He was kind of walking or, you know, just had stopped moving because he was still standing up. And the officers yelled at him to get on the ground. One officer said, pull your hands out. And he didn't get on the ground. And so an officer fired nearly a dozen times at him, struck him several times, but he did survive the shooting.
And I want to talk about, yeah, the extent of his injuries in a little bit. But there's also, I mean, going earlier into the footage, there's the mother of this boy is also seen in the footage. She's the one who actually called police. Is that right, Jessica?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, she's pretty distraught. She's unsure of how to get him to go to a medical facility that's covered by her health insurance. And, you know, she's trying to give the officers as much information as she can, saying that she doesn't think that he has a weapon, but if she wasn't sure that her son had showed like a pellet gun or some sort of like fake gun to one of her employees the day before, but she didn't know if he had it. You know, she's trying to give as much information to the officers as possible before they, you know, go in to try to make contact with him.
There's a few questions that I have still. One is that, is there any sort of visible clue in the footage as to why police shot this boy?
No, and I think that's kind of the frustrating part about this footage. And, you know, a lot of people who, you know, stakeholders in this conversation about releasing body cam footage have been critical of this point of just releasing body cam footage without context, because you don't get that context here. It doesn't really illuminate why the officer felt he needed to fire at Lyndon. He didn't have a weapon on him. He didn't, you know, run towards officers. He didn't make any threats, anything like that. He was just walking. He didn't get to the ground like his officer told him to, but there was no visible, clear escalation of violence. And so that answer of why that officer felt he needed to shoot wasn't really answered in this body cam footage.
There are some sort of, you could call them foreshadowing statements that are made in the body cam footage that was released. The officer involved actually saying that by going there, it was going to end in a shooting. Can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting part about this is the timing is this shooting happened just hours before Salt Lake City's own policies were supposed to be changing. And now, you know, they're supposed to be using de-escalation
right.
in every instance. And so they're kind of in this weird period where the policies haven't quite changed yet. And there's a conversation between two officers where one officer says, you know, is really doing an approach, you know, going into his house for a psych problem. Is that really what we should be doing? Maybe we should call our supervisor, tell him the situation. She says, I'm not going to get into shooting because he's upset. And then the other officer who's the officer who later shot Lyndon replies, you know, yeah, especially if he hates cops, which is what the mother had said, you know, this is going to end in a shooting. So you could see the officers also trying to grapple with how to handle this situation and do what they've been called to do, which is to help get him to a hospital.
And you pointed out that the mother in her 911 call, she said something about, you know, a shootout happening. And something that shocked me in your story, Jessica, was that it turns out that police officers in Nevada, in Western Nevada, had also killed this woman's father. It's just an odd detail that struck me.
Yes, yeah, he was killed in January, I think. So it was the same year that her father was also killed in a shootout with police. I think in that case, I think it's still under investigation, but the allegation was that he had threatened a neighbor with a gun and the police arrived and that also ended in a police shooting and this woman's father died in that.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of places we could go with this. I guess, what are the police saying, Jessica, about the fact that, I mean, about the shooting, how are they indicating at all why this happened?
You know, not really. After this body camera footage came out, or actually, I guess before the body cam footage came out, they had a really short press conference. It was literally 5 minutes. The mayor and the police chief gave a statement, and the chief at that time, you know, said that called this a tragedy, said that they want to analyze what happened through a lens of learning. And, you know, he made the point that too often officers are called to deal with these like very difficult problems, and they're not criminal in nature. The boy wasn't breaking any laws. They just needed help getting him to a hospital, and that's not a crime.
We really haven't talked a lot about the fact that this boy, it lives with autism, that and that obviously plays into his behaviors, and when the police showed up, they were obviously aware of that. You said that this happened on September 3rd. Again, September 5th is the date in which the date that these changes were set to go into effect. One of them was de-escalation, but weren't there some that had to do with changes to policy that had to do with people in a mental health crisis and how police respond?
I believe so. I'm not totally well versed in the specifics on that, but I know that there are, even when this mother, she called and asked for a crisis intervention team to come, and that's not what came that day. So they do have crisis intervention team officers, but my understanding is that the hours that they work are limited in Salt Lake City, that they're more of like a 9-to-5. And so they weren't available during that time. And so she kind of got more of like a generalist, like officers who are trained generally, but are not those experts. They're not, they weren't social workers. They were police officers.
Jessica, how is this 13-year-old boy, Lyndon Cameron? I mean, he's in the hospital. What is the extent of his injuries?
He's going to be hospitalized for quite a while. He was struck several times by bullets in his ankles, intestines, his bladder. His brother told me that, I think it was last week, he told me that, he was just recently able to transfer himself from a hospital bed to a wheelchair, but he's still having trouble talking because it's really painful. He's got some nerve damage, can't feel his arms, things like that. And there's concern that he won't be able to walk normally again. So he did survive the shooting, but he has a long road to go and likely, will not fully recover from these injuries.
And then what's going on with the officers involved? Meaning, are they still on duty? What's happening with those officers?
So it was just one officer that fired. And so that officer, it's pretty much standard protocol. He'll be on leave as Salt Lake District Attorney Sim Gill reviews the case. And so Sim Gill will make that determination of whether the officer was legally justified in firing his weapon, basically, deciding whether there was reasonable belief that the officer had to use force to prevent death or serious bodily injury to himself or to others. So that's the next steps for this case.
And what is there sort of a time frame on how, you said reasonably believe it'll be up to District Attorney Sim Gill to make that determination? What's the general time frame for that determination to be made?
These usually take a while. I mean, there's been times we saw with a more recent shooting involving Bernardo Palacios Carbajal, where Sim Gill, he accelerated that timeline and released it fairly quickly because of public pressure. The mayor's asked for a quick review again with this shooting. And so, it could be a month or two, but, there's some shootings that happened in 2018, more than, 2 years ago, that Sim Gill still hasn't ruled on. So pretty big timeline. It could be anywhere from a couple months to more than a year.
Okay. It's an interesting situation. I mean, this is also in the context of a lot of scrutiny of police shootings, and I guess we wait and see what that determination is. Anything missing from the story, Jessica, before we move on and actually tackle another one of your stories from this past week? But anything we're missing?
No, I think we covered it.
Okay. A reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is @KCPW. And Jessica, I want to turn to a story that I'm kind of going to spring on you. We were originally going to talk about this, and now we're going to talk about it again. But there is a school it's a Provo Canyon School, a treatment facility that kind of gained some notoriety or maybe some national focus after a celebrity went public with allegations that she was physically and mentally abused there. This is, the Provo Canyon School. I'm wondering if you can basically first tell us about Paris Hilton's allegations about this and then what the reporting that you've done since has shown. You've spoken to other people who have similar allegations. Take it away.
Right, yeah. So Paris Hilton came out with a documentary last week where she talks a lot about her life. And you know, a good portion of the documentary, she talks about Provo Canyon School, which is a youth residential treatment center. Sometimes they're called like troubled teen industry or troubled teen facilities. She was sent there in 1999 when she was 17 years old. And, you know, in the documentary, she talks about that she was, you know, physically and mentally abused there, that she was over-medicated. And, you know, after the documentary came out, the company that owns Provo Canyon School now, it's called Universal Health Services, they kind of brushed off the allegations, saying that they couldn't address them because they didn't own the facility in 1999. And so what I did with my reporting was, you know, I've heard from people from, you know, the 80s, the 90s, 2000, 3 years ago, who all kind of have the same allegations. And so I spoke with a lot of former students, most in the time frame that the current owners have owned the school, and they all, you know, have these similar allegations of physical abuse, you know, overusing medication, kids being held in physical restraints, isolation, and things of that nature.
Yeah, and you talked about the repeated physical restraints a lot. I mean, this school has been open for half a century. You talked about the fact that they've changed hands, that there's a different owner now, but and so I don't know if they address, you know, allegations from someone like Paris Hilton, you know, a celebrity, but do they have anything to say about that long history of alleged abuse that you describe in your article?
You know, the only thing they've really said, they said they couldn't comment on specific cases because of privacy laws, but the CEO of the school did note that, you know, mental health treatment has kind of evolved over the past 20 years from behaviors-based foundation, is how they said it, to a more personalized, trauma-informed response. They've said that the facility doesn't use solitary confinement and don't use drugs or medications as a disciplinary measure. So, you know, they've said that, but, you know, I've also heard from kids who have been in the facility in the last, you know, 5 or 7 years, where they're saying that chemical restraints, they call it booty juice, like when kids are like shot up with this Haldol, it's like sedative, or, you know, physical restraints, they're being held down, that those are still happening as recently. I think the most recent case I've talked to, she went in 2017, so it's been happening more recently still, according to the people who've been there.
Sorry, I just have to ask, is booty juice because there's an injection, you know, into the buttocks? Is that the idea there?
Yes, yeah, that's it. And I've, you know, heard from a lot of people that it's something it's used kind of frequently, but it's almost always used as like a threat that the staff would say, you know, you don't want to get booty juice or things like that.
Huh. How often do facilities like this use chemical restraint? That seems... And I guess they obviously have to have the permission of parents to do that. Can you talk about that part, Jessica?
Yeah, so it is allowed in Utah rules to use these sort of chemical restraints on children. They're supposed to get permission from parents or like a prescription. From what I've seen from interviews that I've done and from looking at police records, it doesn't seem like that's always the case. It doesn't seem like something that's done ahead of time. Like, for instance, I read some police reports about a riot that happened at another facility owned by Universal Health Services. And from the documentation from the police, it appeared that a nurse was just going to from kid to kid and giving them these sedative shots, you know, that obviously wasn't with a parent's permission or with, you know, a physician's permission. It was just a way to like control the kids and get them to calm down.
You also spoke with an expert, Jessica, on the sort of national picture of treatment centers and the fact that they do face these persistent allegations of abuse and mistreatment. Not, you know, obviously not every single one, but that there is at the national level, there's a lot of focus on this. And this is Ronald Davidson, who was the director of mental health policy, a program at the University of Illinois. And he was also at Chicago's Department of Psychiatry. Anyway, the point of this is that that there have been a lot of accusations about these facilities, and that part of the problem might be the profit margin, the drive to make money that maybe impels some of this behavior. I don't know. Can you talk about what he said?
Yeah. So, you know, for him, he spoke a lot about how, you know, a lot of times there is a difference between these large for-profit, I mean, all of these facilities are for-profit. It's kind of unusual to see a nonprofit facility. They do exist, but most of them are for-profit. But when you see these larger networks like Universal Health Services, they own like four here. They own hundreds of hospitals and care centers across the country. And, you know, other companies like Sequel, that they've identified this like recurring pattern of risk factors where, you know, staffing levels tend to be low or staff are like undertrained. You know, the frontline staff are not paid well, so they generally aren't very qualified. They're kids in college or just out of college. You know, incidents of serious harm and abuse are high. Children are often over-medicated and over-restrained, and those are the facilities that generally are making a lot of money.
The counter sort of statement to that is something that the CEO of Provo Canyon School said to you, which is that he worried that the kind of media focus on all of that could increase the stigma around people seeking help. I don't know. Can you talk about that too?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's kind of the interesting and difficult part about this industry is, you know, a lot of times they are dealing with young people who have complex needs and they're, you know, can be a danger to themselves or others. But, you know, people who advocate for reform for this industry kind of make the point that, you know, warehousing kids and over-medicating them is not really helping them. And maybe that there's better ways that we can do mental health for young people in the country.
All right. Jessica Miller, I'm going to ask you the question I always ask you, which is anything that you want to add or that we're missing from the story before we head to a break?
I think we're good for now.
All right. Jessica Miller is a reporter with Salt Lake Tribune. We've also been hearing from Lee Davidson, another reporter. We're going to take a quick break on the show. There's still more to come. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jessica Miller and Lee Davidson. It is our Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Well, Utah has again seen its highest single-day increase in coronavirus cases. That's for the second time in a week. During his monthly news conference, the governor announced that the state recorded 1,198 new coronavirus cases on Thursday. Utah's previous single-day high was on Friday. And part of that ongoing spike was an increase in Utah County. And as a result, the governor announced on Tuesday that he was returning the cities of Provo and Orem to the orange or moderate risk coronavirus restriction levels. I know that neither of you, Jessica or Lee, covered this story. I'm just going to keep kind of summing it up. The governor was asked on Thursday if he favors, you know, sort of a statewide approach. He was actually asked this question by Fox 13's Ben Winslow. If he, you know, now seeing the spike in cases, if he wanted to go to a larger statewide measure of some sort. And I'm just going to play a clip of what he had to say, and then maybe we'll come back, Lee, and talk about vaccines. I know that that's something that you covered. Take a listen quickly to what Governor Gary Herbert had to say when asked about a statewide response.
Certainly, we always have that on the table to consider. But as you look at some of our areas of the state of Utah, you go to Garfield County, you're out in the Uinta Basin or up in Rich County, Paiute, some of our rural areas, to have a statewide mask mandate doesn't make a lot of sense in those areas. They have virtually no infections and no deaths. And so, again, we have enough divisiveness out there as it is, but there's not really any benefit to a statewide mask mandate in those parts of the state. So we've left that, as you know, we've been consistent on saying if there's a need for those kinds of more strict measures, we look to the local government people who know what's best, know the demographics, know the culture, know the situation as well as anybody, if not better than anybody, to make those kinds of decisions. So,
And it trails off there. This is where we are in the pandemic. I mean, we have had 444 deaths total from the pandemic virus, the illness that the virus causes. 67,000 total cases, more than 67,000 cases. And I'm actually now going to turn Lee Davidson to a story that you reported going back to Senator Mitt Romney and a conversation that he had with Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. And some of the questions that Romney posed to Fauci kind of revealed a timeline for a potential vaccine. And I'm wondering if you can just kind of bring us up to speed on that before we turn to our underplayed stories of the week, Lee.
Sure. President Donald Trump has repeatedly predicted that a vaccine for COVID-19 will be available before the November 3rd election. And so Romney was asking some questions saying, okay, if that's the case and a vaccine actually comes out, what does that mean? Does it mean that Americans will all get the vaccine pretty quickly or not? And he asked Dr. Fauci that, and Fauci said, actually, it means that, you know, not all that many people are going to get it. He says it's not going to be a large proportion of the population. And then he explained why. There are lots of different companies working on a vaccine. Each of them need to get separate approval, and so that approval will likely roll out at different times. A lot of companies are manufacturing their vaccine in advance in hopes that it will be become approved and available.
Right.
And he said the numbers you hear about how many vaccine doses will be available include all of those together, but they're not going to be available at the same time. They're going to be approved at different times. And so Fauci said, November, maybe 50 million doses available by December, 100 plus. He said, even if things are approved before the election, it's going to be March or April before doses are available to the majority of Americans. So even with kind of a November surprise sort of thing where a vaccine's available, most people won't see it for quite a while. Those who would see it quickly are maybe healthcare workers and maybe the people who are most vulnerable.
And of course, this is all pending, the science bearing out the fact that the vaccines are functioning. And that was something that was stressed in this hearing earlier.
Right.
Yeah. With that, I will point listeners to conversations that I've had with Andy Larson about vaccines and also about a reticence among some to take the vaccine and what that might mean in terms of public health. But for now, I'll say thanks very much, Lee Davidson, for bringing us up to speed on that. And with that, to save time for a recorded segment with Public Lands reporter Brian Maffley, we will turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And Lee, why don't I start with you? Do you have a pick ready for underplayed story?
Sure. It seems like Congress doesn't do a lot sometimes, but there was a little bill that passed this week that Chris Stewart of Utah pushed that may actually save lives. It creates a new hotline, new suicide hotline. It will be 988, and similar to 911 that you can call to report an emergency anywhere in America. Soon, when you dial 988, you will be connected to a suicide hotline. A lot of folks didn't know what the number was, and it changed from state to state. So This is a nice little bill.
Okay. That's a great pick from Lee Davidson. Jessica Miller, we'll wrap up with you just to save time. What's your pick for underplayed story?
So I'm going to point to an episode of Trib Talk that we did yesterday. This is a live chat that we do on the Salt Lake Tribune's Facebook page, kind of going with the story I just talked about with the troubled teen industry. I spoke with Jen Robison, who founded this social movement where people who'd been in these treatment centers speak about abuse that they say they suffered there. There's a ton of these places in Utah. It's not just Provo Canyon School. It's an industry that really thrives here. So it's worth checking out that conversation.
All right. Check that out at the Tribune's Facebook page. Jessica Miller and Lee Davidson, I'm going to cut us off. Thanks for joining me today on Behind the Headlines.
Thank you.
For the rest of the show, we'll turn to my conversation with Salt Lake Tribune public lands reporter Brian Maffley about a controversial highway proposal to link up two parts of eastern Utah. Take a listen. Brian Maffley, Salt Lake Tribune public lands reporter, thanks for making time for this, as always.
Yeah, you bet. It's always good to be on your show, dude.
Thanks, man. So you reported this week on a resurrected rural highway proposal, and actually resurrected might not be the right word because it's one that's kind of been languishing. It's just been sitting there. It never really went away. This is a proposal to connect two parts of the state of Utah. And tell me if I'm right about this. It's kind of a more direct line between Vernal and Moab, more or less, right? That's what we're talking about?
Yeah, and it goes through some of the most rugged country in Utah, from the southern part of the Uinta Basin, through the Tablepuch Plateau, through the Book Cliffs, and down to Interstate 70 near Cisco. And the idea is it's a shortcut from, you know, the Uinta Basin down to Grand County, so people don't have to drive all the way around through Indian Canyon to the west, through, you know, Price or Wellington, and or through Colorado to the east. And so the original proposal 30 years ago was basically to, you know, help get the oil from the Uinta Basin out of the basin to, you know, rail and freeway corridors down in Grand County. And it's been controversial since day one. And the original proposal is what led to Grand County going from a changing its form of government to a 3-member county commission to a 7-member county council. And here we are, you know, 30 years later, and this proposal just won't go away. And Grand County is, most of its elected leaders are dead set against it. Even though this whole road would occur in Grand County, they don't want it.
Right. Every mile of this road you report would be in Grand County. They don't want it. I guess two things. Why don't they want it? And then also, who's behind this road proposal, Brian?
Well, this time it's had many iterations. Previously, the Utah Department of Transportation had proposed it back when it was a straight up, you know, oil moving proposal. And now it's the 7-County Infrastructure Coalition is proposing it. They've taken over this idea. So basically, it would connect the end of Seabridge Road, which was paved several years ago, which goes all the way to the Grand County line in the Uinta Basin, basically connect the end of that paved road down to I-70. And so the 7-County Infrastructure Coalition, is their whole mission is to build the infrastructure to move things like oil and coal and whatever around the state. But in this case, they're saying, no, we're not going to build this to move oil. They actually have a railroad project in the works for that purpose. This is about promoting tourism, right? To help people get from the Mighty Five down in Grand County and in Southern Utah with these beautiful attractions in the northeastern part of the state, you know, Flaming Gorge, Dinosaur National Monument, and even Teton National Park to the north. So they're packaging now as a tourism promotion project, and the Grand County Commission is not buying it for a second.
So, right, originally you said it was going to serve basically extractive industries. Now the stated reason is tourism for Grand County, but Grand County doesn't want this, so... So how do the proponents of this square that with... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I think it's more about promoting tourism in Uinta County, which could, and basically make an easier way to get to Uinta County from those Mighty Five destinations like Arches and Canyonlands, which get, as everyone knows, gets literally millions of international and national tourists. And this will make it supposedly an easier way to get to Uinta County, which, you know, frankly, look, it doesn't see a lot of tourism. And I think there are folks in that county that would like to get in on it. And then you have Grand County, which is just overrun with tourists. So, you know, maybe there's some logic there. But I had a long talk with Grand County Commission Chairwoman Mary McGann about this. And one of the reasons for her skepticism is that this road, which would cost between $200 and $400 million, would only knock off at most half hour off the, maybe even less, off the trip between Moab and Vernal. So it's like, really, is it half hour shorter drive really worth it to cut a highway through some really beautiful country? This is a place that's got a lot of big game habitat. Hunters really love this. This is like a paradise if you're a big game hunter, and people like it the way it is. There's a lot of ranchers there as well that might not be psyched about having a highway through there. But that said, it will. We are a state with more and more traffic, and this could ease the burden on Highway 40 and Highway 191, you know?
I guess maybe you could talk about the process here, Brian. It's hundreds of millions of dollars. The Bureau of Land Management is kind of behind or kind of in charge. How does this go forward? What is the process for by which this happens?
Well, how the 7-County Infrastructure Coalition resurrected the project was they filed for a right-of-way application with the BLM, 35-mile right-of-way that follows a number of existing roads through the Book Cliffs. And this particular route was one of three studied back in 2013, 2014 by UDOT. And this was the alignment that go that's the farthest to the east. And it's supposedly the one that will cost the least and have the smallest environmental footprint. And so the 7-County group has now hired a third-party consultant to write the EIS, Environmental Impact Statement. And it's just getting started. They haven't even started the scoping process or anything like that. So it's in its utter total infancy in terms of process, but it's a proposal. Let's get it straight though. Proposal's been studied to death for 30 years and it's been a huge source of controversy the whole time.
So, I mean, it's interesting. Is would you say that the getting to the step of environmental impact study is kind of an advanced place to be? Without the support of the county through which the road runs, is this advanced? Are we proceeding forward? And who else is behind this?
Yeah, well, the state is definitely behind it. The governor has given a vote of support for this, which is what the BLM wanted to see before moving forward on processing the right-of-way application. They wanted to see, you know, political support. They wanted to see financial support. So the state is basically saying, you know, we're behind this. We're going to help get this thing built. However, what Mary McGann of the Grand County Commission found so galling was, gee, you know, the governor has signed off on his tentative approval on this without asking her county what they think. Usually you'd think that the county that would have the road would be the county that's proposing the road. Here it's totally upside down. It's the county that's going to have the road actually does not want the road. And so more important background here, Grand County was part of the 7-County Infrastructure Coalition. They pulled out in 2014. They actually voted the commissioners out of office who approved joining the coalition, voted them out, and the new commission, the first order of business was pulling out of the coalition. And the issue was this proposed road. Back then in 2014, the road was very much of an active proposal. So I thought this road was, you know, dead as a doornail back then. And I guess I was wrong. It's come back.
Part of the governor's stated reason for support for the road is the idea of creating rural jobs.
Yes.
I mean, obviously there would be jobs in the construction of the road, but beyond that, as people drive through it, is this a job creator?
That's so the study that is one of the proponents, I'm not sure if it was Uinta County or the 7-County group, they commissioned an economic study a few years ago that calculated the economic benefit would be like $250 million to the state's economy. And a lot of it was about, you know, tourism jobs in Uinta and Daggett County. And I think that's where the governor is headed with this. His letter is very interesting. It doesn't mention one word about energy development or getting Uinta Basin's oil to market, which is interesting because that was the main rationale for the project back in 2013. So now it seems everyone should be a little bit skeptical that what oil and gas has nothing to do with this. Probably a little hard to believe. However, that's what they're saying. So
yeah.
I really report it.
How about, I don't know if this is in your story, but how about in terms of cultural or archaeological significance? I know that there are some, you know, even as you head in from Thompson Springs, there are some pictographs and petroglyphs in that area.
I'm glad you brought that up because my story didn't get into that, but there are lots of archaeological sites in those canyons in the Book Cliffs. And one of the proposed routes was Sago Canyon, which has lots and lots of resources. And for that reason, and others, that alignment is not going to be considered anymore. But it's like Nine Mile Canyon. You know, they've paved a road through Nine Mile Canyon to the west. And in some ways, the argument there was, you know, paving the road actually may have been good for the rock art in Nine Mile Canyon, because it's now there's not nearly as much dust kicked up by all the traffic that goes through there. But of course, now there's a lot of traffic that goes through there that wasn't going through there before. And of course, there's almost no traffic going through these canyons, the East Canyon, Hay Canyon, and Sago Canyon. I mean, they're pretty rugged dirt roads. They're not passable much of the year. And if it's raining, forget it. This road that would be built to high standards and all season, all weather road. So the road, the Book Cliffs Highway, which is now being referred to as the Eastern Utah Regional Connection, should it get built, it will open up a part of Utah that sees very little traffic right now. And that could mean people will be getting into areas that they're not getting into now. And what does that mean for the archaeology there, the wildlife habitat? We know what happens. It'll change the character of that landscape.
Yeah, have an impact. I guess last question I have for you, Brian, is public input. Is there a mechanism by which the public can express their opinion about this?
Yeah, I think there will be when the BLM initiates its environmental impact statement. And so they'll post something on the Federal Register that will invite scoping comment, and there'll be a period of time for that, but that hasn't occurred yet. So there'll be plenty of opportunities for public comment at some point.
Okay. Brian Maffley, public lands reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks again for making time.
You betcha. Roger, dude, see you around.
And that's it for Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.